And I'm actually going to open up a work session. Actually, I'd like to welcome, before I do that, yes, we're in work session, I can say whatever, but I want to welcome Representative Burley, who we're very, very pleased is back from his little back surgery. And we're glad to see you sitting upright. And Representative, we did have an opportunity to actually go around and introduce ourselves, so I am going to ask if you'll just do a brief introduction.
Okay.
Everybody.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. It's great to be back, too. I'm State Representative Chuck Burley, House District 54, which represents the city of Bend. This is my second term here in the legislature. Professionally, I'm a forester, so a lot of the things that we'll be discussing in this committee are of great interest to me, and hopefully I'll be able to contribute positively, and look forward to it. I think the agenda that we've got, especially on the renewables, is outstanding. It's great policy, and I'm looking forward to it very much, so thank you.
Great. Well, I'm really pleased that you were able to return so quickly, and we'll make sure and try to keep you in good health, so we won't send you back to the hospital. Okay, so we are in a work session.
Well, Madam Chair, would you like me to make a motion?
Yes, you have before you, members, three LC drafts. And actually, Kat, do you want to start off with the first one?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
A brief introduction.
LC 1737, which is requested by Representative Dingfelder, it amends ORS 469 relating to minimum energy efficiency standards for appliances and certain other products. The standards were established last session under House Bill 3363. That was to parallel California standards. Excuse me. California's law was subsequently revised, and LC 1737 conforms the standards and operative dates to those changes in the California law.
And I will just add, committee members, that this was a bill that passed overwhelmingly last session. I think there were only four no votes from what I can remember. This is the energy efficiency bill that increased efficiency standards for 11 appliances and saved about $230 million in energy cost savings over 20 years. This actually is after some discussions during the interim with the manufacturers. They had requested the date being changed so we were consistent with California, and of course, because we don't have annual sessions. Okay, that's $20 in the pizza bank there. Just a reminder to everybody in the audience, too. We have a sign up about turning off your raspberries. I thought that was really good.
How embarrassing.
It's okay. There'll be other opportunities, I'm sure, Representative. So this is to make sure that we're consistent with California law, which was the intent of the legislation that passed last time. It truly is just a technical fix. And this was at the request of the manufacturers who actually will be manufacturing these products.
Madam Chair, I move that LC 1737 be introduced as a committee bill.
Okay. And I just want to point out for committee members that any of the bills that we're introducing here today doesn't mean that you're supporting the bill. It means that you are allowing these bills to be introduced for further discussion. There will be public hearings on each and every one of these bills. And your yes vote on introduction as a committee bill does not commit you in any way in voting yes when this bill comes to the committee. So I just want to be clear about that.
Okay. I'll restate my motion,
Thank
which was
you.
To move LC 1737 as a committee bill.
Okay. Representative Cannon moves the adoption of LC 1737. Any discussion?
Second.
Thank you. Those who are of the opinion that LC 1737 should be adopted will vote aye. Those opposed will vote no. The assistant will call the roll.
Representative Smith?
Excused.
Representative Fire?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Yeah.
Representative Burley?
Aye.
Representative Cannon?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Chair Dingfelder?
Aye. Okay, so...
Madam Chair.
Representative Jensen?
Go ahead. You're going to gavel on that.
On that one, and then...
Okay. Madam Chair, I just a point of inquiry on this. I think you said adopted, and Is that what you...
Oh, it should be introduction. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Thank you. So I stand corrected that Representative Cannon had moved the introduction of LC 1737. Thank you, Representative Jensen. For those of you in the audience who don't know, as I mentioned before, I've learned everything that I know about. But fortunately, I have my mentor here to make sure I'm doing this right. So
and
are there any...
She's in real trouble.
Yeah. Are there any objections to introducing LC 1737? I'm hearing none. So ordered. Okay, Kat, can you please briefly describe the next LC?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, LC 1767 eliminates the exemption from requirement for registration, certificate, or permit for certain uses of groundwater appropriated on or after the effective date of the Act. It declares an emergency effective on passage.
And committee members, as I just mentioned, this is this and the issue you'll hear next, actually... Thank you. We will have some very robust discussions in this committee. And just a little bit of background without going into too much detail because we will have opportunities for further discussion on this. This LC, let's see, make sure I'm speaking on the right one. Just so you know, under Oregon law, the use of groundwater up to 15,000 gallons per day for single or group domestic purposes and for up to 5,000 gallons per day for a single industrial or commercial purpose is exempt from the requirement to obtain a permit from the Water Resources Department. So this bill will engage us in a discussion about policies. I think it's a good timing to have a discussion on that, especially when we have some water quality, groundwater quantity limited areas in the state, and so I'm looking forward to a very robust discussion about it.
Madam Chair, I move that LC 1767 be introduced as a committee bill.
Representative Cannon moves the introduction of LC 1767. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing none.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Jensen.
Representative Jensen. I'm trying to read this. And is this retroactive, or will this be retroactive to any current uses?
No, that's not the intent. And again, this is a starting point for discussion. I just want to be clear on that.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I will support the motion if it was seconded. But I would like to note that until we have those discussions, it's problematic how I would vote in the. And I realize you've already told us that we're not bound in any way by this vote, but I just wanted to be clear. I need to follow this legislation before I make any firm commitments where I'm going.
I appreciate that, Representative, and it's so noted for the record.
Yeah.
Thank you. So will the clerk call the roll, please?
Representative Smith. Representative Byers.
Aye.
Representative Jackson.
Aye.
Representative Burley.
Aye.
Representative Cannon.
Aye.
Representative McPherson.
Aye.
Chair Dingfelder.
Aye. Without hearing any objection, LC 1767 is introduced in the committee. And Kat, will you please briefly describe the next measure?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. LC 1768 requires all water users to measure amounts of water withdrawn or stored. It applies to new water users on or after the effective date of the Act. It applies to existing water users on and after January 1st, 2012. It allows Water Resources Commission to require water users to report water use measurements, and it declares an emergency effective on passage.
Okay, thank you, Kat. And again, this is an issue that has been around for a long time. Representative Jensen and I have been discussing this for, I think, about 5 years. So we'll probably continue those discussions. That's part of the point of introducing this measure. Just for the background of the committee, I have a memo dated September 12, 2006, information that I requested from the State Water Resources Department. that says currently statewide approximately 8% of surface water and groundwater rights are required to measure either by statute for public entities or by permit condition. And so that is part of the purpose, is to have a broader discussion about water measurement and impacts on fish and domestic and industrial use. So this, again, is a starting point for a discussion. I know that there'll be, again, lots of interest in this bill, and we're looking forward to a good discussion here in the committee.
Madam Chair, I move that LC 1768 be introduced as a committee bill.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Cannon moves the introduction of LC 1768. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the chair, bringing this bill forward. For those people who will be following and watching it, this bill as we move through the process, it should be noted that I had originally planned to bring a bill of this nature before the group. I'll hold that to just simply prevent the world from getting too cumbersome with too many water bills. And, while there's a lot of controversy that we will hear about in relationship to this bill, and it'll certainly attract pros and cons on both sides of the issue, and we'll undoubtedly have a number of amendments proposed before we're through. I am going to be supportive of the chair's bill here, and would think that I probably will support it all the way through, but again, that remains for the final bill for me to be able to make that decision on.
Thank you, Representative Jensen, for sharing those comments. Representative Beyer?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to, at the risk of being redundant, let it be known that I have never worked on water issues before. I am certainly looking forward to an interesting and educational discussion, but I just want to make sure that I'm not committing a vote to anything that I don't know that much about at this point.
Thank you, Representative Beyer. That is noted for the record, and believe me, you would be well immersed in water issues by the end of this committee. So with that note, and any other discussion? Those who are of the opinion that LC 1768 should be introduced will vote aye. Those opposed will vote no. The assistant will call the roll.
Representative Smith, excuse. Representative Beyer.
Aye.
Representative Jensen.
Aye.
Representative Burley.
Aye.
Representative Cannon.
Aye.
Representative McPherson.
Aye.
Chair
Dingfelder. Aye. Okay, without hearing any objections, LC 1768 is introduced as a committee bill. So with that, I will close the work session, and I will open up an informational meeting. Thank you, committee members. Appreciate your attention on that. And today we are going to hear from several agencies that will be coming before us on many different occasions. I've asked these agencies to come in and provide some background information to help some of the committee members who are new to some of these issue areas. For some of us, we're much more familiar with the programs, but I think it's very important for all of the committee members to get up to speed on some of the issues they'll be hearing about throughout the session. So we've asked four different agencies to come in and talk about their programs, talk about their legislative agendas, and help us sort of become, as I mentioned, immersed in some of the water and issues that we'll be hearing. The four agencies that are coming forward today are all state agencies that do deal with water issues, water and fish issues. So we're going to hear about 15 minutes from each agency at the max, and then we'll leave time for questions after each panel. First, we're going to hear from Louise Soliday, who is the director of the Department of State Lands. Welcome, Louise. And she'll tell you all about what the Department of State Lands does and why we need to care in this committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Louise Soliday, the director of the Department of State Lands. I want to do two things today. I want to do a quick agency overview, just to familiarize everybody with the programs that the Department is responsible for overseeing, and then secondly, talk a little bit about our legislative concepts, three of which have been referred to this committee. First of all, the Department of State Lands is one of the oldest agencies in the state of Oregon, having been created back in 1878 to manage the Common School Fund trust lands which were granted to the state at statehood for the purpose of financing a public education system. Our oversight policy body is the State Land Board, and that's comprised of the governor, the secretary of state, and the treasurer. We have a number of overarching responsibilities that are assigned to the Department of State Lands. The overarching responsibility is to generate revenue to the Common School Fund for the purpose of making distributions twice a year to our K-12 school districts around the state. In order to do that, we manage both a real estate portfolio and a financial portfolio. Within our real estate portfolio, we have about 2.1 million acres of land in a variety of land classes, including rangelands, agricultural lands, timberlands, industrial, commercial, residential lands, and special use lands, along with mineral rights that we hold on many of those acres. In addition, we manage another $2.1 million of mineral rights that are underneath lands that are held by other state agencies. So we have a very large real estate portfolio that we're responsible for managing, and we do that under an asset management plan, which the Land Board adopts. We also have responsibility for regulating removal fill activities in the state of Oregon and waters of the state. And we've been doing that since 1967, when the original removal fill law first passed in the state of Oregon. We also manage wetlands conservation and mitigation programs under a statute that was passed in 1989. In addition to the land management functions and the regulatory functions, we also handle two other fiscal programs in the state of Oregon. One is to manage estates of people who die without wills and heirs. And when that occurs, the state, the Department of State Lands becomes the administrator for those estates, and we spend 10 years trying to find the heirs, any heirs for those estates. If we're unsuccessful in doing that, the money escheats to the Common School Fund and becomes a permanent part of the Common School Fund. We also manage what's called the Unclaimed Property Program in the state of Oregon, and those are properties, both intangible and tangible, that are turned over to the state by various holders, banks, insurance companies, stockbrokers, a whole range of entities. And those monies properties are held in trust in perpetuity while we try to locate the rightful owner of those properties. We also have two small programs that are associated with the Department of State Lands, and that's the South Slough National Estuarine Research Reserve in Charleston, which is 4,700 acres of estuary and uplands that were the first estuary program created in the country as part of a national system of estuarine reserves around the country. And we also oversee what's called the Oregon Natural Heritage Program, which is a program that's been in existence for just over 25 years. And there is a council which we staff that oversees that program. In terms of our funding sources, our main funding source is the Common School Fund, which is where we charge expenditures for our Common School Fund expenses. We also get federal grants, most of those through the South Slough program, and a little bit into our wetlands program and some of our streamlining efforts that we have underway within the last year or two. And we get a tiny bit of general fund that pays for our economic revitalization team staff person, and a little bit of general fund that goes to the Oregon Natural Heritage Program, but the vast majority of our budget comes from the Common School Fund. We have a staffing of 99 FTE. About 20% of those are limited duration positions because they're on soft money or because the legislature wanted us to try them on a limited basis before we made them permanent. And we have three offices, including our Salem office, which we own as a Common School Fund asset. It's not owned by the Department of Administrative Services. It's actually owned by the Department of State Lands, and it's one of our revenue producers for the Common School Fund. We rent space in Bend for our Eastern Oregon staff, and we have our offices for South Slough down in Charleston, Oregon, right on the grounds of South Slough. We've September of 2005, we went through a major agency reorganization, which actually predates my tenure there as the agency director. And we've divided the agency into four divisions, with the director's office, including both the communications and the human resources functions in my office, so very small group, four of us. A finance and administration division, which takes care of our centralized services, including our fiscal services and our information systems services, and the estates and the unclaimed property programs are within that division. Then we have a land management division, which is our division whose job it is to produce revenue off of the common school fund lands, and so they are responsible for purchase and sale of lands, leasing of lands, licensing uses on our property, and the whole range of land management activities that we're engaged in. And then we have a wetlands and waterways division, which has overall responsibility for the removal fill regulatory program and our wetlands conservation and mitigation programs. And again, we also have as separate program units, SIL, SLU, and the Oregon Natural Heritage Program. So that's sort of the 40,000-foot flyover of who we are and what we do. And you'll hear more particularly about the removal fill program, I think, in this committee as the session moves forward, and as well as the wetlands program. The department has five legislative bills that have been introduced this session by the governor. Two of those deal with our unclaimed property program. One is to reduce the dormancy period, the time between when an account goes dormant and it needs to be turned over to the state of Oregon, which is House Bill 2104, which is the first bill on the green sheet. You're not likely to be involved in any discussion on that bill, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that. House Bill 21, and the second unclaimed property bill is Senate Bill 67, which is on the back of the green sheet, and that actually is a proposal at the request of the State Land Board to move the unclaimed property program from the Department of State Lands to the Office of the State Treasurer. In most states, the unclaimed property program is in the Office of the State Treasurer. And, you know, as people have been asking me about this, I always tell them that if I had unclaimed property that I was trying to find, the Department of State Lands is probably not the first place I think of to call. There is this is the second time around for this proposal, and the department will be supporting that bill, which will actually be heard next Tuesday on the Senate side. So we have two unclaimed property bills. The other three bills have been referred to this committee, and I want to just take a little bit of time to talk about those. The first is House Bill 2105. That is a proposal that's been in this body, before this body, several sessions in a row, and it's a proposal to increase our general fees for removal fill permit applications that we receive and process. The department has not had a fee increase since 1989, and as you can imagine, our costs of that program have grown over time, and those costs have been shifted to the Common School Fund. And so the Common School Fund is now paying a large percentage, between 80 and 90% of the cost of our regulatory program, and the fees are picking up between 10 and 20% of that program. When the fees were first initiated, they were picking up about 60% of the program. Common School Fund was picking up about 40%. So we've moved away from the reliance on fees and shifted that burden onto the Common School Fund.
Louise, yes. I'm going to interrupt you for just a minute. What is the dollar figure associated with that 80 to 90%? Do you have that?
Madam Chair, I believe off the top of my head for a biennium, I believe we're in about a $700,000 range that we get from fees, and our program is running about $3.5 million.
So the Common School Fund is then subsidizing
that's correct.
The difference.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
This bill also would allow us to begin charging a fee for general authorizations and emergency authorizations, which we have not done historically. And so the idea is to begin to recover more of our costs of that program from the fees that are paid by the applicants in the program. The next bill that's been referred to this committee is House Bill 2106, and this is a proposal for a brand new fee. And this would be a fee for our staff to do reviews and concurrences on wetland delineations and determinations. When we get a removal fill application and wet for activities in wetlands, we require first a determination whether there are wetlands on that property, and if there are, then a delineation about where they are. And that's how we determine what amount of mitigation needs to be done if we permit development to occur on those in those wetlands. We have a very small staff of three who have not been increased in size, even though the amount of wetland determinations and delineations has increased significantly over the years. And as a result, we now prioritize those reports when they come in the door, and we end up tiering in a three-tier system all those reports. And we have a backlog that continues to grow of wetland delineation determination reports that we are not getting to. We also, because we are driven by our permits, are almost never getting to doing reports, reviewing reports, unless there is a permit in our door. From my perspective, that's sort of backwards. It means that developers have gone out and they've developed their developments, not knowing for sure where their wetlands are on their property or whether we agree with where they think they are. And oftentimes we end up sending developers back to the redesign process because we end up disagreeing with the report that has been submitted to us. From my perspective, we would prefer to have those wetland delineations in the door well before we get a permit application so that we can do the review and concurrence well in advance of final designs being done so that when the permit application comes in the door, those wetland delineations have been agreed to, the mitigation is the appropriate amount, and people can get a quicker green light from us in the permit process. In order to do that, we need more staff. And we've been talking to some developers, our wetland consultants, the cities and counties about this issue, and I think we have fairly broad support for this new fee. They think it's a small amount to pay in order to get this process set up in the right direction. We would guarantee that those reviews and concurrences would be done within a time certain, coming in the door, 120 days, so that anybody who comes in, we're going to turn a report around within 120 days, and they can finish their process and submit their permit application to us. So that's the goal of that bill. And then the last bill that we have that's in front of has been referred to this committee is one that's a result of a budget note that the Department of State Lands and several other natural resource agencies got in the 2005 session, and that was to look at how we can better streamline state permitting for activities in waters of the state. And there has been a group meeting in the interim called the RIPIT group, which is the Water Related Permit Process Improvement Team, who have been working hard in the interim to design a process where we would integrate several other state authorizations that are needed within the DSL removal fill permit process. And we are, this bill, House Bill 2251, is proposing that we try a pilot project in the 0709 biennium to begin to integrate other state agency authorizations through the DSL permit process and see if, in fact, we end up with a streamlined process for our applicants who have to now go through into multiple doors in order to get all the authorizations that they need to do activities in waters of the state. And the goal is to create a single door for them to come through and a single process for them to go through. And when they come out the back end, they have all the state authorizations that they need through a single process. And so we want to test this process. And we want to test it because we want to make sure we hit the mark before we try and implement something permanently. And what we envision is we will take some small set of our permits, probably 50 or so a year, and run them through this pilot project and see if we've hit the mark, do some fine-tuning if we need to before we come back with a proposal to permanently implement it in the next session. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Louise, and you way under mark on the time, so I appreciate that. But are there any questions for Louise from the committee members? Representative McPherson?
I do, Madam Chair. Ms. Soliday, the one bill that you kind of went over briefly in summarizing the agenda, your legislative proposals that has caught my eye was this moving of the unclaimed property program. And I just, I don't know if that'll be referred to this committee or not when it comes over to the House side, but since we have such a long-standing history of unclaimed property going to the Common School Fund, I wanted to find out the rationale for, I mean, it's stated that it raised the profile of the program and allow people to more readily claim their unclaimed property, but the tradition of having unclaimed property go to this Common School Fund is pretty deeply embedded in Oregon history, and so I wanted to hear the rationale for that.
Madam Chair and Representative McPherson, the proceeds would still go into the Common School Fund. So we're going to transfer the staff that's at DSL to the Treasurer's Office, but the Common School Fund would still pay the expenditures. The property would go into the Common School Fund and be held in the trust fund in the Common School Fund in perpetuity to reconnect the holders, the owners with the property.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, thank you. And we'll be seeing more of the Department of State Lands when their bills come up for hearings.
Madam Chair, if I might just do one thing. Kevin Moynihan is my new assistant director for the Wetlands and Waterways Conservation Division. He's going to be working the three bills that are before this committee, so I just wanted to introduce him, and I think he and Jeanette are coming to visit all of you sometime in the next couple of weeks to talk about these bills. So
great. Thank you. We'll look forward to seeing you, Kevin. Okay, next I'd like to invite up the Department of Environmental Quality. And we have Greg Aldrich. Also, committee members, I just want to mention you have a sheet that says member chart on it. This is a revised member chart. You all received a notebook on the first committee day, so please tear out that and replace it with this. Unfortunately, there were some inaccuracies, and we want to make sure that we have everybody's correct contact information. So that's just informational for
Madam
you.
Chair.
Yes.
And it probably doesn't matter because it's spelled the same way, but my staff person's name is spelled wrong.
Of course, that she's related to you, isn't she?
Yes.
So, yes. Okay, so noted.
And her first name is wrong.
Okay, so if you have any other changes, please let our committee administrator know, and she will have yet another revised version for you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Jensen.
Yes, since we're dealing with the topic of spelling.
Do we spell Evelyn's name wrong?
No, but you spell Jensen differently than that.
Yes, so noted.
At least you're supposed to, because I see it on my
name. Yeah, we should have caught that. So if you have any other changes, please let our committee administrator know, so she will absolutely have the correct names.
Need to move the dash threes.
Yes, we'll have the dash threes of the member chart that Representative McPherson will introduce. You do still represent Lake Oswego, right?
Okay. Yes, I do.
Okay, we got that right. Okay. Yes, and before we go on, I will just make sure so I don't forget this, is that we, starting Wednesday next week, we are going to be holding hearings in Hearing Room A, and those will be joint hearings with the House Revenue Committee. That is the start of the biofuels hearing. So check, please make sure and check the agendas. It'll be posted. But just so you know, we will be in this room on Monday, and then starting Wednesday for, I think, three sessions, we will be meeting jointly with the House Revenue Committee to hear the biofuels bills and the Betsy and Retsy Business Energy Tax Credit, Residential Energy Tax Credit, and we will have a very full agendas on those 3 days. So with that, can you please introduce yourself for the record?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Greg Aldridge, Government Relations Manager of the Department of Environmental Quality. Thank you for this opportunity to provide an overview of our legislative concepts and also provide an overview of some of the key water issues that we're addressing. With me today is Christine Spekovich of the Water Quality Program. Also, DEQ does have an air quality program, and they will be before you on Monday, and a land quality program. Before you is a summary sheet that looks like this. It contains information regarding DEQ bills. And I just wanted to let you know up front that if you have need for additional information, please let me know. First, I'll start with the first two bills that have been assigned to this committee. First is House Bill 2118, Underground Injection Control. Some people may know it as the UIC program. This program primarily focuses on managing stormwater from developed areas such as parking lots and roads, and is to ensure that stormwater put into the ground does not contaminate our groundwater. Currently, DEQ receives funding for less than one FTE, and this is not a full-time equivalent position, and this is not adequate to implement a statewide program. Over time, we've lost all our general fund in this program. Since we cannot adequately run this program, DEQ started in 2006 to return this program to EPA, but stakeholders expressed concerns and went to our own governing board, the Environmental Quality Commission, and asked if there was a way to keep the program in the state. And what they asked is if we would go forward to this legislature and ask, in fact, if we could establish a fee program, which this bill is an attempt to do. This would give us authority to charge fees and to establish fees for the program. Again, if we are not successful in doing that, we would go back to the path of relinquishing the program to EPA because we know we cannot run an adequate program with the current staffing. There is a fact sheet with more details attached to the summary sheet. The second bill that's before this will be for this committee is House Bill 2172, Clean Diesel. Diesel engine exhaust is among the most prevalent toxic air pollutants in Oregon and contributes significantly to fine particulate pollution, regional haze, smog, and global warming, all significant issues in Oregon. The bill will reduce public health risks from diesel emissions by offering a variety of incentives to diesel engine users. These include a clean diesel fund to retrofit, rebuild, or scrap old engines and to reduce vehicle idling, a clean diesel tax credit for up to 50%, a clean engine replacement incentives, and then clean school bus grants. The clean diesel program is a priority of the governor, and the governor's recommended budget includes general funding for $3 million and federal funding at $1.5 million. And attaches another fact sheet for more details about this program. The next five DEQ bills have been assigned to the Senate Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources. Essentially, they are fee bills, though some of them do have statutory language changes, and let me briefly summarize them here. Senate Bill 103 is maintaining our hazardous waste delegation program. It's been approved by EPA, but over time we've fallen into a shortfall of funding of over $1.6 million. We are addressing the shortfall by cutting some staff and by coming forward with this fee increase for $400,000. In addition, we are talking with stakeholders about how to close the funding gap because the two do not add up to the $1.6 million. SB 104 is maintaining underground storage tanks. These are tanks to control petroleum products, and DEQ's work is primarily paid for by the annual fee on these tanks. The last legislature extended the annual tank fee of $85 into January 1st, 2008. This concept would continue the tank fee, and DEQ is coordinating with fee payers to determine the specific amount that should be proposed. Obviously, if this does not go forward, then the program would cease to exist, or at least the funding component would. Senate Bill 105, maintaining marine spill planning. Oregon statute prohibits the entry of a ship or operation of a terminal or pipeline capable of storing 10,000 gallons of oil in Oregon waters without an emergency spill contingency plan approved by our agency. We review the plans and do test drills to make sure that the plans can be fully implemented. This package raises the oil spill prevention fees so that we can maintain adequate staff to fulfill our role in implementing the program. SB 106 is our heating oil tanks program, which is basically for residential oil tanks. This was designed as a DEQ license with DEQ licensed contractors to decommission tanks, clean up leaks, and provide certification work that was should be done in accordance with our standard established standards. An important element to this was making sure the DEQ would audit the contractors' works to ensure that the standards are met. However, over time, decommissionings and cleanups have really consumed most of our staff time, and we have not been able to focus on auditing. There have been a number of fraudulent contractor issues that have affected a number of homeowners. This fee package would add an FTE for an auditor position to address those issues. And the last fee bill is Senate Bill 107, the Title V air permit fees. This is a federally mandated operating permit program for the largest air sources in Oregon. There's over 120 of them. The Federal Clean Air Act mandates that fees cover all costs associated with running this program, and the fees have been set in statute and with the provision that the Environmental Quality Commission can increase those fees based on the Consumer Price Index each year. However, revenue has not kept up with the cost of inflation, so we are have gotten to the point where we've had to cut staff and cannot maintain a good program. An overall increase of 24% in fees would allow restoration of the program and build up fund balances so we wouldn't be asking for fee increases in the next couple of years. Senate Bill 235 is agricultural air quality. This is a joint ledge concept that was developed by DEQ and the Department of Agriculture with representatives of the agricultural community and environmentalists. And it's to allow regulation of agriculture to the extent necessary to comply with the Federal Clean Air Act. And the bill was filed with the Department of Agriculture. Currently, there's no exemption for the federal clean or for agricultural emissions in the Federal Clean Air Act, but we have one in the state statute, and this is a provision to change that. Right now, we're facing a petition that was filed to EPA that could revoke our ability to operate the air program in the state. If this bill were to go forward, it would meet the issues of that petition. Next is Senate Bill 338, which is Heat Smart. This bill was originally drafted by DEQ and then was filed by the Interim Committee on Natural Resources and Alternative Energy. And it's to deal with residential uncertified wood stoves, which are a cause of pollution and put public health at risk. Based on new EPA data and new standards, a number of our areas in the state are either going to not meet the new fine for particulate matter standards or will be threatening to exceed them. And examples would be Oak Ridge and Klamath Falls. And wood stoves are primary cause of that. This bill would allow for funding through a diversion of open burning penalties and asbestos penalties into a grant program that could be used to assist people in changing out their older stoves. And finally, HB 2272 is low emission vehicle registration. This has been assigned to House Transportation Committee and filed by DMV, and this is to allow us to implement the Oregon Low Emission Vehicle Program in the state, which takes effect for the 2009 model year. And with that, I would like to turn it over to Christine for an overview of the water quality program.
Great. Thank you. Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Christine Svetkovich, and I am the legislative coordinator for the water quality program at the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. And I'm here today to give just a brief overview on some of the high priority work that the water quality program is working on and on some of our budget proposals. As outlined in the fact sheet that's titled Water Quality Program Priorities 2006-2007, our number one priority is to improve our water quality permit program. We've been working for the last couple of years on a number of program changes, and at the end of this month, we'll be sharing with you our annual report, which outlines our progress to date. Our second priority that we've been working on is to complete the number of clean water plans that are needed, which are also called total maximum daily loads, for us to meet our consent decree under our federal court order. This past year, we've completed two very large of those water plans, one in the Willamette and one in the Umpqua Basin, and right now are on target to meet those goals. Our third priority that we're working on is to develop a long-term strategy for water quality improvements. due to past budget constraints, we haven't had the opportunity in a long time to take a step back and look at what's coming at us in the future and where we might want to go. So that's the point of that. Our fourth high priority is to ensure that we have a high-performing team so that we're working together well. And our fifth priority is to adopt a strategic plan for infrastructure. Again, due to budget constraints over the past many years, our infrastructure has been eroded seriously. And so the strategy that we're working on will be designed to ensure that we are being as effective and efficient as we can as a program. Moving on to the fact sheet that's titled 2007-2009 Water Quality Budget Proposals, this fact sheet outlines, it provides an overview of all of our budget proposals that are included in the governor's recommended budget. I'm not going to go over each of them individually, but I just want to note that most of these packages will provide funds for us to do our core work. And the only new work that's included in these is to establish a toxics monitoring program. And the reason that we're doing that is because we get asked from many different directions about toxics and waterways, and we're not able to answer those questions. So what we did is we put together a budget proposal to establish a program that would begin work in the Willamette River watershed. It's established so that we would work with different agencies and the community to ensure that we knew about all the existing data so that we could determine which toxic pollutants may be present in that area and based on land use, existing data, and sources that are in that area. We would develop a monitoring plan. We'd collect water and fish tissue samples. Then we'd use those results to determine if there are levels of toxic pollutants that are a threat to human health or the environment. And then we'd work with the communities to the local communities to reduce any pollution that was found. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Thank you both. And I just want to make a comment to the committee before I take questions in that many of the bills that we will be hearing from the agency, from DEQ, will be referred to the Ways and Means Committee, is my understanding. I think there's one or two that will be referred to revenue if it's a tax credit, but the majority of these will be referred. We will hear and have discussions on the policy, and then we will refer to Ways and Means. That's correct. I'm glad we're sharing the wealth with the Transportation Committee, at least on one of the bills, and as you have the chair of the Transportation Committee here. So with that, I will take any questions for the panel. You guys did an amazing job. Well, thank you very much. We will be hearing question. Representative Jensen, hold on, has a question. We will be hearing, I know, a lot from you, and I'm sure we will have questions as the bills come up. Representative Jensen.
The drinking water program to have listed here. Could you be more specific with me what bill or what content of any bills might be on that?
It's on the 0709 water quality budget proposal.
Madam Chair, Representative Jensen, that the drinking water program is just for us to continue to receive money that comes through the Department of Human Services. And we go out and we do testing and we work with communities and we work with the Department of Health. And so this is just giving us the limitation to accept those funds. It's not increasing and it's not a bill.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Representative Jensen has a follow up.
In the past two sessions, the Department of Health has had a bill before the legislature to expand the number of tests, the testing of water sources, and I'm curious if you're bringing that bill or a comparable bill forward, or if this is going to be coming from the Health Department.
Madam Chair, Representative Jensen, no, we are not bringing forth that bill.
And Representative Jensen, we will be hearing from Gail Shipley from the Department of Health on Monday.
Okay.
And actually, they do have a bill that they're bringing forward. Actually, to my understanding is to increase funding for doing testing for community water supplies, but she will be here on Monday.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Madam Chair, I do have a question. I think it's for
Representative Cannon.
Thank you. It's I think for Greg. I think we're going to hear from Andy Ginsberg on Monday, but perhaps you can preview any steps that DEQ might be taking to petition the EPA around benzene levels in our air. Is DEQ active on that issue?
Representative Cannon, you're the chair. DEQ is active, and I know Andy Ginsberg will be talking about Monday in quite a bit of detail. We have responded through letters back to EPA when they proposed the rule, and I think we're looking at ways that we can be more proactive, knowing that there's a lot of constraints that what a state can do. But you'll hear the details on Monday. I'm sorry I can't provide all of them right now.
Thank you.
This is, as Representative Cannon's question, Andy Ginsberg, who is the Air Quality Division Director, will be here on Monday to talk about specifically clean diesel program, benzene, and I think some other air quality programs. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much. I'm sure we'll be seeing you around some more. I'm not losing my quorum. You can show them if you want. Okay, next I'm going to call up the Water Resources Department. We have Phil Ward, the director, and Debbie Colbert, who's the senior policy coordinator. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Phil Ward, and I am the director of the Oregon Water Resources Department. Happy to be here with you today. And I'll ask Debbie Colbert to do the lion's share of the work today, since she's the person that you'll see most regularly representing our agency. But I did want to mention just a couple little factoids about the Department of Water Resources as we get started here. We are the folks that manage the state's water resource from a quantity standpoint, so we're the water supply people. We have about 80,000, a little over 80,000 water rights around the state, and those water rights are both for out-of-stream use, what you would customarily characterize as use on a farm or in a city, but we also have a number of water rights for in-stream use or in-stream values to protect the in-stream values needed from a resource protection standpoint. Our water code here in the state was adopted in 1909, but we are still adjudicating some of the pre-1909 claims for water use in different parts of the state, most notably in the Klamath Basin. As you can imagine, sometimes conflict arises in the water business, and I'm sure we'll get to talk through some of those issues as we work through some of the things that will be facing your committee today. But we are really, I think, pleased with the direction of the water community here in the state of Oregon in terms of working through the really challenging issues facing this precious resource in Oregon. We're primarily a general fund budget agency. Do have some fees, and one of the pieces of legislation Dr. Colbert's going to be talking with you about is a fee adjustment bill that will come before this committee. So with that, Madam Chair, I'll conclude and ask Debbie to introduce herself.
Great. Thank you. Debbie?
Hello. For the record, my name is Debbie Colbert with the Water Resources Department, and I just want to thank you for the opportunity to be here today to talk to you about the legislative concepts that our department has requested that the governor introduce on our behalf. I handed out a one-page sheet that shows you these seven bills. The first five are House bills. All of them have been referred to this committee. And I'll just walk through them each very quickly for you. The first bill, House Bill 2097, is a bill that removes a sunset on an existing authority in statute. We have a lot of statutory authorities related to our ability to take existing water rights and put them back in stream for fish and water quality and recreation purposes. This particular program allows a water right holder to use their water right for a portion of their authorized season and then put it in stream during another portion. And although it hasn't been used very much since it was authorized in 2001, it is a great opportunity. It's a tool that we'd like to keep in the toolbox in terms of restoring flows in Oregon. The next bill is House Bill 2098. This is a bill that allows, that changes the way that our commission uses its authority to extend irrigation seasons. Under the current statute, our Water Resources Commission can extend the irrigation season within a subbasin by order of the commission. Through this bill, we're asking that the commission do that through a rulemaking process rather than by order. And the fundamental reason is that for these orders of our commission to be final orders under the Administrative Procedures Act, they have to be served on all affected parties or persons within the subbasin. And we've been advised by our attorneys that that's a pretty high bar when you're doing it on that kind of geographic scale. And so instead, we're proposing to go to a rulemaking process. We think that this actually will be good for water users and others affected because that will make us go more toward a process where we have to have a hearing in the local basin, and they'll have a lot more notice and opportunities for input. The next bill that's listed here is a fee adjustment bill that's related to our department's authority to cancel water rights that have been forfeited due to 5 years or more, consecutive years or more of non-use. And the way that it works today is that if our department receives some minimum amount of evidence that's required by law that asserts that a water user has forfeited their right, by law we go to a cancellation proceeding. And in order for that water right holder to argue with this, they have to request a contested case hearing and pay a $250 protest fee. So this concept is that if they prevail through that hearing process and demonstrate that they haven't forfeited their right, then we would have the authority to refund a portion or all of their fee. And this was a concept that our Water Resources Commission was very interested in and felt that it was a fairness issue in terms of our ability to refund this money. The next bill, House Bill 2100, relates to exempt uses of water in the state. Under current statute, certain entities, rural fire protection districts and public fire departments, can work with our water masters to use water to do non-emergency firefighting training. And so this is where they're going out with their crews and putting pumps in perhaps streams to divert water to deal with fires and just practicing doing that effort. These particular entities under law can have this authority without getting a water right permit from our department, as long as they work with our water master, and our water master will ensure that there's no negative impacts on other water right holders or in-stream resources or water quality as part of the current statute. This bill would propose to allow this opportunity to other types of entities as well, like the Oregon Department of Forestry and the Oregon Military Department. The next bill is House Bill 2101. This is another fee adjustment bill, and this is dealing with two of our major program areas. It's fees associated with our water rights permitting and our water right transfers applications. And it's essentially a fee increment that would continue these programs for another 4 years, and it supports about 8 staff in our water right permitting group and 2 staff in our water right transfers group. We had a last increment in these program areas in 2003, and we were encouraged to come back rather than waiting for long periods and having large jumps in our fees, to come back more regularly and ask for incremental changes in these fees.
Ted, I have a quick question on that. What percentage of program costs do your fees currently cover?
Currently, in water rights permitting and transfers, we get about a 30% cost recovery, and the rest is covered by general fund.
And Madam Chair, this bill would not change that ratio. It would maintain that ratio.
Okay, thank you.
So the last two bills on this sheet are Senate bills. The first one has been assigned to the Business, Transportation, and Workforce Development Committee. It's a bill to remove a sunset on our continuing education program for well constructors. In 2001, by statute, it was created a continuing education for well constructors. This program will sunset on January 2nd, 2008. We think it's been a great success in terms of increasing the kind of skill levels of well constructors around the state in a way that ensures our groundwater resources are best protected. So we're asking to remove that sunset from the program. And then the last bill is Senate Bill 89. This has been referred to the Environment and Natural Resources Committee, and it proposes to extend a sunset on a pilot program for certain irrigation districts. This program would sunset in 2008. We're asking that it sunset in 2000 instead. It allows a couple districts across the state, the Oahe Irrigation District, Tualatin Valley Irrigation District, and Talent Irrigation District, to do annual place of use changes within their districts within certain constraints. And we're hoping to observe this pilot program and see if we can give districts more flexibility to move water around annually within their districts without having any loss of protections for other water right holders in the resource. We're asking for a two-year extension because it took a little while for both our department and the districts to ramp up and start using this pilot. So we really only have two irrigation seasons under our belt and not very many changes. So we'd like to have two more so that we can adequately assess how things are going under the pilot program. So that's the seven bills that we are pursuing this, and thank you very much again for letting us come and tell you about them.
Thank you. Committee members, do you have any questions on these bills? Okay. I do have a question for you. Not going to get away that easily. I noticed that the Water Supply and Conservation Initiative is not listed on the sheet, and I realize that is not a separate piece of legislation. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that is correct. The Oregon Water Supply and Conservation Initiative is a budget policy option package that the governor's included in his recommended budget for the department. We do have a one-pager that we have with us.
Well, I think we have time, so if you can spend a few minutes on that, I think that's going to be an important policy discussion that we would like to have in this committee. And you do have several members of the Ways and Means Committee sitting right here, so we will be seeing you on multiple occasions, but I think it would be useful to have that conversation in this committee, even though there's no legislation attached to it.
Madam Chair, with your permission, then I think I'll lead out on that, and we're happy to talk with you about it. We've been talking with members individually as we've met with folks in the building in the last week. This is a policy option package, as Debbie mentioned, that is in the governor's budget to the tune of just short of $900,000. And it will do essentially five things. And these are five things that we think are extremely important for the state to do in the years ahead to develop a strategy for meeting its long-term water supply needs. The first thing it will do is it will assess those needs. What are the current unmet needs for water supply in Oregon today? And what are the needs 20 years down the road? So what are our current and what will be our future needs on the near-term horizon? The second thing it will do is develop an inventory of potential sites to store water, to take water in the winter when it's plentiful, store it, use it in the summer. And these don't just include what you would characterize as traditional above-ground storage sites with a dam, a reservoir with a dam. But we're having some really significant, in our view, success doing some experiments around the state with aquifer storage and recovery, where we put water from in the winter back down in the ground and use it in the summer. The most notable of those experiments that we have going today is with the city of Pendleton, where they are taking Umatilla River water, running it through their municipal water treatment plant to clean it up so we get the water quality standards that DEQ and Health Division need, run it back down into their municipal wells in the winter, which have been declining significantly over time in water level. Today, the city of Pendleton, Representative Jensen's home country, uses 60% Umatilla River water to meet their municipal supply and only 40% native groundwater. These are the kind of things we want to identify, the places around the state where the geology exists where we can do that kind of water storage. We think there's tremendous potential. Right now, as I mentioned, we have municipalities, 10 different municipalities, in various stages of these kind of experiments. So we're hopeful. We feel like we need to take a good look at where that can be done around the state. The third thing, this is a critically important piece of this proposal, but we feel like there needs to be a statewide analysis of where we can gain more water supply through conservation and reuse of water. We think, and Representative Dingfelter regularly reminds me of the importance of taking this kind of look, taking a look at water supply from this vantage point, that there are gains that can continue to be made here in our state in terms of conservation of water that will actually boost our supply for the years ahead. So that's a piece. The fourth piece is what we call a statewide investigation of basin yield analysis. It's an analysis statewide of basin yields. What that means is, how much water does a basin produce? Is there any left over after you meet the existing needs so that you can store some of that? So we're working with ODF&W and others to identify the fish needs so we don't miss those winter fish needs and that kind of thing. But we think this is an important piece. The last piece, Madam Chair and members, is something that we heard regularly from our local partners as we talked about this concept around the state, and that is the need to have a small pool of money where we can help local jurisdictions who are doing water supply planning, where we can seed into that process and help them get some of these things done. So, Madam Chair, that's the concept. Again, as I mentioned at the outset, we think this is important to the development and implementation of a statewide strategy for meeting Oregon's water supply in the years ahead. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for the panel? Okay. I appreciate it. We will be inviting you back to talk more about this. And one of the things I will probably ask you to bring with you is sort of a history of water supply planning in the state. I've only been working in water resources management for 20 years, but I know that there's many studies that have been done during that time frame, and folks who have been doing this a lot longer than I have talk about the 208 planning and lots of other plans. So I think it would be helpful to set a context for this committee to talk about planning that has been done both at the statewide and regional level in the past, how this is different, how this is going to fit in and not duplicate but complement those efforts. So I will ask you to maybe do some homework and come back and talk about that. Also, how it fits in with the individual municipal plans, the irrigation district plans. We have a lot of planning, and how this would certainly coordinate with the different plans that are going on currently in the state.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We'll be happy to do that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, but last but not least, we have hiding in the back the Department of Fish and Wildlife. And we have the director with us today, and also the deputy director. Thank you. Thank you for coming, gentlemen, on short notice.
Chair Dingfelter, committee chair, members. I'm Virgil Moore. I'm the director of Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, relatively new to the scene, getting my legs under me. And we have four legislative concepts that Roy will be talking about today. Roy will be the face over here, as he has been in the past, but I want to be sure you know that I'm always available to the committee for discussions, and will be around and available. With that, I will turn it over to Roy for his presentation on the legislative concepts.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. And
I don't think we were hiding in the back. We were just, yeah, that's where the seats were empty when we came in. But besides that, Madam Chair, I would like to start with our four concepts, and in particular the concept that will be started in this committee in the legislature is our House Bill 2994. That will include essentially revisions to our about the 10-year-old fish screening and passage landowners cost share program, a program that really has roots as far back as in this body, 1989, when at that time the body asked the department to do a study of unscreened water diversions and their impacts on fishery resources around the state. And during that two-year period, we came up with a priority listing of about 3,500 fish water diversions that were unscreened and causing significant harm to fishery resources. Based on that 1989 study the department did, we went ahead and worked with the agricultural communities, the water use community, and the sport fishing communities, and came up with a pilot fish screening cost share program, essentially a 60-40 program, funded at the time by a small amount of general fund and a 25-cent license, fishing license surcharge collected by the department. And that was the beginning of our pilot cost share program, where a landowner of a screen of a water version under 30 cubic feet per second could come to the department, request to be in the cost share program, and in the end, 60% of the cost of putting a fish screening device on his diversion or her diversion would be paid by the department through this fund. 40% of it would come from the landowner, and that would also include in-kind as well as cash. So it's been a very successful program. In 1995, it was made permanent, and then in 1999, with the Oregon Plan, it got significant boost in emphasis and interest by the inclusion of quite a bit of OWEB funding, which is in the program today, Measure 66. And with a program that's almost probably total $4 to $5 million at this point, with federal funding, sport angling funding, OWEB funding, and other outside funding, we thought it was time to make some revisions to the program so the statutes clearly reflect what we do on the ground now, particularly with some of the OWEB monies. And for instance, the best example I have is when the program was passed, particularly as a pilot cost share, it listed as a goal that 75 diversions should be screened each year, 150 per biennium. Well, it made no mention of what size those diversions would be. So as time went on and we were screening bigger and bigger diversions, you know, a small, what we call pump screen, which may be a screen of flow of 1 to 3 cubic feet per second on the success list, on the legislative success list, would count the same as if we did a 50 cubic feet per second diversion, which is a very large $100,000, $200,000 project. So that's an example of some of the revisions we're making. We've worked very closely with the water user community and sport angling community and others, so I think you'll find when we come before this committee a lot of support for these changes. And the other thing is that the fish screening program does have its own permanent advisory body made up of sport fishing, agriculture, and the public interest, 7-person body that meets around the state quarterly called the Fish Screening Advisory Task Force. They advise the department on policy on fish screening, and these revisions and changes were carefully worked with them because they do represent the user community of the process. So I go on the top of page 2 and list some of the other changes we're going to do. Again, we'll be back in front of this committee, Madam Chair, and talk about in detail about the program itself and about the changes we'd like to see. Senate Bill 241, which is revisions to a program that is very probably few people in this body are aware of or even Oregonians. It's a marine commercial fisheries program, which essentially it's called the Developmental Fisheries Program. And it's a program to provide control of development to encourage those fishermen who pioneer a new fishery to invest their time and energy in that and avoid pitfalls of unconstrained development. So I guess in my mind it's like a California gold rush, and that's what this is designed to do. When you have somebody who in the fishing, commercial fishing industry, who finds a market niche and starts to fish on previously unfished for species, let's say in this example, bay clams, And he develops a market for those clams and comes up and designs a technology to efficiently harvest those clams. He comes to the department, and we work closely with him to make sure that we don't have unrestrained, you know, too many people getting into this business too early, and that it's going to be a safe economic community for the state, and it's going to be sustainable over time. So those are, and now we have some minor revisions to that program, and since it is in statute, that's why we're coming back with some statutory changes. And we lay out in that section of bond, page 2, really one of the key elements is how we're going to we're moving the review of denials from the permit board that now go to the commission. We're going to move those to where other commercial fisheries permits are discussed to the commercial fisheries review board. The next two are wildlife issues that probably would not start it or come to this committee, but I'll cover them quickly. One is Senate Bill 240, which is our landowner preference program, our special Southwest Oregon pilot program. I think that'd be interest particularly you, Representative Burley. I know you always are interested in landowner preference. We're going to be actually having a hearing on this next Tuesday in the Senate Natural Resources Committee. The program there, I guess, to put it in a nutshell, our program there is we have a set of statutes that lay out a statewide landowner preference program. That program is designed for landowners who own a certain amount of property to be able for them and their family to hunt on that property without going through a what we call a controlled hunt process, which is essentially a lottery people get into to apply to hunt big game on a certain area. If you own land in that area, you don't need to go through that big lottery process. You automatically, based on your acreage, can get some tags for you and your family, and you also use a couple for sale, for instance. What we have in southwestern Oregon was developed, though, is because we have a lot of small but high-value agricultural property owners there with some significant big game damage, particularly from elk. The usual method of allowing them to have some extra landowner preference harvest tags to control that number of elk that caused damage to the property, since it's a small piece, the elk would come and go in a night's time, and then they're off the property. And the special tags are good only for the property they're issued for. So what we've designed, working with the local hunter community and local landowner community down there, and shepherded at the time by Representative Cruz, was a system that we would work closely more in a kind of a block approach, where small landowners in that period, if we knew where those elk were coming from, whether it's public land or adjoining private property, we would be able to take those elk off. You know, we know they're causing damage to certain private lands. We'd still be able to follow up and harvest those elk and reduce their numbers, even though at the time when they were taken, when they were actually killed, they wouldn't be on that person's property. It's a little complex, but it's been a good program so far. All we're doing is looking to extend the sunset because we have 2 full years of information right now in assessing whether the program is being successful. In discussions with the advisory board as we approach the sunset in 2008, the department and the advisory board that's helped on this decided that really 2 years of implementation is not enough for us to quite decide if we need to make some changes to the program or it's being successful as is. So moving the sunset out a few more years allows us to collect more information and seeing how successful the program is. Is it really reducing damage to the target lands and target crops that we're seeking for? So the last one, our Wolf Bill. And I think I see several members of this committee who are familiar from last session with our Wolf Bill. Madam Chair, it will be in Representative Roblin's committee, and I think there's a sigh of relief I see around on
except
that.
For the two members who also serve on Senate, on Representative Roblin's committee. So.
And essentially, we are working again. We have a Wolf Plan in place, and there is some legislation that would more fully implement that plan. On the top of page 5, we really lay out the 4 major points for which legislation will do the bill is designed to give landowners more assistance in the tools in the end they will have to be able to protect their livestock when wolves do arrive in the state. So I know you want to keep it 15 minutes, Madam Chair. I'm not sure how we did here, but certainly open for any questions on this or other issues. Appreciate the opportunity today.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. Any questions for this panel or burning questions about wolves?
I don't think time permits for that.
Yeah, I'm sure. We will have time in the... No, seriously, though, for the two first legislative... Well, two out of the four will be coming through this, is my sense, will be coming through this committee, even though both of them are Senate bills. Is that correct? The first one is a House bill.
Sorry. Yes, ma'am. Yes, Madam Chair. I haven't talked to the committee administrator yet, but it's my sense that the particularly the fish greening bill, we wanted to start in your committee with your interest in water and the interest here. And we'll have good testimony, good support for this bill from the water use community as well as from the sport fishing community. It's been a very successful program.
I did have a question about that, and I know we'll have more discussions when we have hearings on the bill, but who is eligible for the cost share program? And also, I just want to be clear that everyone knows exactly why we need fish screening. And so you may want to just step back a little bit and explain why this program came to be.
Well, there's always been, and some, even in the Oregon Constitution, it mentions the importance of fish, the importance of letting protecting fish, and particularly fish passage. But it's interesting that in the early years of, say, even the 20th century, if you read books about salmon in early Oregon, some of the accounts we'll read is that when they first opened the irrigation ditches in the spring, particularly in northeast Oregon, Fort Hell's Canyon dam process, dams were put in stuff, when they first would open their irrigation diversions in the spring, landowners could look out and see a sea of silver on their fields at times, which were essentially all the smolts that normally would be in the river going downriver would have been diverted through you know, ditches where the water just came out of the river, flowed to the fields, and those little fish ended up by the thousands would go out into farm fields, and then within a day or two there would be thousands of seagulls who would then go down there and feed on all those little fish. And essentially fish greens are different devices, and actually when we come in, we have some small model scales, Madam Chair, we'll bring, and we'll be, you know, we have, it's a very interesting kind of technology. I was happy to be the program manager for 3 or 4 years in that program. But essentially, these are devices designed to allow the water to flow unimpeded for the landowner and to protect their water rights so they get the water they need for their crops or whatever they have, a proper water right from water resources, while keeping the fish in the water body from where the water is coming from. And essentially, usually close to where a ditch would leave a water body, you'd have some sort of rotating screen so that dirt stays off it and stuff. And then there's a return flow. So most of the water goes through the ditch, but there's a little bit of water flow where the fish are collected, and then they have a way of swimming right back into the creek or river, wherever it is. It's really interesting. And the department has had done fish greening work since the 1940s, and we've had fish greening shops since 1940s. We used to have an extensive amount of work in northeastern Oregon for the Hell's Canyon dam process.
Eligibility
is open to any water user,
including municipalities.
It has to do with the size of the diversion. But under the current rules, I believe municipalities are allowed on a small diversion under 30 cubic feet per second to apply, but I'd have to double-check that. But we can have all that when we come back.
Okay.
But essentially, it got designed for the small to medium water user. In other words, folks at the time in 89, 91, 93 felt that we needed to find a way to help the smaller landowners, the small water diverters, with ways for them to protect fish. Most of the time, municipalities, big power companies, and the bigger water users like irrigation districts, which are taxing districts, I think everyone knows, they have ways to have money to protect fish. And so in the law, if you divert over 30 cubic feet per second, you do have, it's a mandatory, you must screen. But the cost share program was designed for the water user under 30 feet per second, which were generally thought to be small landowners, small agriculturalists, and other folks that need to divert water but really may not have the means to have the technology and to return the fish to the thing. And that's how the whole thing evolved between the small and medium-sized water users and the sport fishing community that, you know, instantly saw that, hey, these are fish that we're going to fish for. We're willing to have a surcharge on our fishing licenses to help fund this program.
Okay.
So that's a nutshell, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yeah, Representative Verley.
Thank you. It's an outstanding program. I can remember as a kid fishing in the irrigation ditches. You know, and I remember back in the early 90s when I was very involved with some Columbia River issues, salmon issues, and, you know, discussions with Montana, Idaho, and all the other states in that basin and dealing with this very issue. And I think it's great that the state is stepping up and helping those smaller landowners. And I'd offer any time anybody's in Bend. We've got a brand new one there with the North Unit Irrigation Canal. It's absolutely state-of-the-art, and it's a wonderful facility, and it's a great, very easy thing to go see if you want to see it sometime. So if anybody's over and like that, I'd do that.
And I do wish we had time for field trips during the session. That is probably not, but certainly during the interim, I would like the committee to take a look at some fish passage projects and some diversion projects. So I think it would, or screening, I think it would be really valuable. And maybe talk a minute about fish passage. And at some point, I will ask you to come back and talk about your recovery planning process.
Sure.
Although you don't have any legislation, I think, because that's a big part of what the department's doing in restoring, you know, salmon runs in the state. I think I would like you to come and provide some overview on that. But maybe you can just talk briefly about passage and why that's important as well, especially since roads are a big impact on our salmon habitat.
Well, Madam Chair, first I do want to say also back to your field trip is right in the Salem area, we have several state-of-the-art fish screening and passage facilities. So I would be very happy to facilitate putting together we could do it in probably less than half a day, 2-3 hour trip. Everything from the Santam Water Control District under Larry Trocey, who some of you may know, and others. We really do have some state-of-the-art fish passage screening stuff right here in the area, which we could hit and go talk about. And they're really so interesting, the technology and the thought, because these devices have to be one of the main things, I'm sorry, Madam Chair, let me just make this point, I'll move on. But one of the main things about these fish screens is the water velocity as it approaches the screen. If the devices, and that's why you usually see these screens on a slant, if the water hits the screen very hard, the fish are essentially impinged on the screen, go either get killed right away or damaged or end up going down the water diversion anyway. So there's a lot of engineering on this a velocity flow, the size of the mesh, and you really, like I said, as program manager, I was always fascinated with all the engineering, and again, you're always looking for kind of a soft, the water moves down the ditch at such and such a speed, at such and such a level, and again, it's all to allow the fish to use its own kind of mobility to kind of find a way out of the maze and back into the creek. And the amount of engineering that takes is amazing sometimes, and I love to do that field trip thing. Fish passage is something that we just recently, and I was proud to lead an effort as part of the program manager, we had two-year task forces that worked on new fish passage statutes for the state that were passed just 4 years ago. And we also are starting to find monies to put into fish passage programs, and particularly little things like road culverts, which really can impact whether or not fish can move up under the road or not. Again, a lot has to do with barriers and water velocity, stuff like that, to even our big fish ladder projects over dams. Those who've been to Bonneville Dam, those are engineering technologies too. So we go all the way from new road culverts, fish-friendly designs, to huge things like fish passage over Bonneville Dam and everything in between, any kind of water diversion. We are really making great strides in the last 4 or 5 years on fish passage. And like I said, Madam Chair, you're talking to the right guy. I'd be happy to come back, and we can talk about that, too.
Didn't you go to law school, Roy? I think you should have been an engineer or hydrologist instead.
Well, thank you. We'd be happy to do that, and also happy we'd probably have Ed Bowles come back and some other staff and talk about our extensive recovery planning, which is the coastal coho, and now into other things as well.
Great, thank you. And I think we have one more question from Representative Burley.
He triggered another thought. Are you involved with the efforts with the Pouton Roundview complex as far as getting the steelhead and salmon back over the dams, or is that pretty much the tribes and PGE? And
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, no, we are very much involved as well with the power companies, the tribes, and the federal agencies.
That, Madam Chair, is just the, I kind of call it the Star Wars project, what they're going to do there. But, you know, I really hope it's successful. It's a great effort, and I would love to be able to go steelheading right there in Bend instead of having to drive all the way down to the Maupin area to do it. But it's a great program, and I'm something I think we might want to follow as well.
Be happy to
be another
that.
Field trip.
Yeah,
well, thank you, gentlemen. Really appreciate it. And before we adjourn, I just want to mention that on Monday, actually, we will have Tom Beiler, who's the executive director of the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board, which the funding for many of those fish passage projects comes from the Measure 66 lottery dollars. And that has been a big component in many of these projects throughout the state. And I know that's where you guys work a lot with OWEB. So just to let the committee know, we'll be hearing from them. We'll also be hearing from the Department of Public Health or Environmental Public Health from DHS. And they will be talking about the Safe Drinking Water Act. And as we heard Representative Jensen ask today about their funding, so they're going to come in and talk about their program. We'll also have Lane Shetterly, who's the director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development, give us an overview, give us an update on what's happening as they're processing their Measure 37 claims and talk about their legislative proposals. And then the Department of Environmental Quality will be back, the director of the Air Quality Division, Andy Ginsberg, to talk about benzene and clean diesel. So we will have another informational hearing in this room on Monday, and then reminder on Wednesday we'll be moving on to biofuels. Thank you so much, and unless there are any final questions for the panel, the Committee on Energy and Environment will adjourn. Thank you. And